you'll hear the injury in the New Yorker writer John Colapinto's voice right away. He's not self-conscious about it, doesn't seem overly sensitive, though he knows not having access to his full voice has had an impact on his life, on his personality, on the way he presents himself to the world. And it's one thing to damage your speaking voice. It's something else when you love to sing.
20 years ago now, I was invited to be the lead singer in a rock band that was being put together by Jan Wenner, the owner of Rolling Stone, where I was a staff writer. And I eagerly jumped in to do it. I'd been an amateur singer my whole life. Knew nothing about vocal warm-ups, though. So I would launch myself into these rehearsals, singing at the top of my lungs over these cranked-up electric instruments. So I quickly developed a rasp, and I thought, well, it'll clear up. It always has. This didn't clear up. It sort of stayed that way. A growl, really, much worse than what you're hearing now if you're hearing some rasp. A vocal coach in my building, actually, I didn't know she was a vocal coach. I was new to this building. She heard me speak and said, you've got a bad injury. You might want to have that looked at by a doctor just in case it's something else. The very next day, I believe, or maybe it was the day after, that I was in Mount Sinai in the office of one of the best vocal surgeons in the country. Actually, his name is Pete Wu. He looked down my throat and said, you have got a vocal polyp. And he showed me it on the screen. And yeah, on one of the vocal cords, instead of it being nice and straight the way it was supposed to be, it had like a lump. But I ignored it. And I managed to maintain that for 10 years until I was doing a story for The New Yorker about a vocal surgeon. And if you can believe it, I had so pushed this to my sort of unconscious that when I jumped on the story idea, I wasn't even thinking of my own voice. I literally was thinking, oh, this is cool. This guy saved Adele's career by removing a polyp. So I phoned Dr. Zeitels, which is his name, and I didn't have the first sentence out before he said, it sounds like you're dealing with a pretty bad vocal issue yourself. And he insisted on looking at my throat. And I eventually let him do it. And he said, you know, this is not just a matter of your singing voice. This is changing you in ways that you're not acknowledging when you just talk. I thought, what? And he said, you know, one of the things that you've taught yourself to do in the last decade is to lower your voice into a register where you can more or less sound sort of smooth-ish. But he said, in doing that, you're actually putting your voice into a restricted pitch range, which is preventing you the kind of melodic elasticity of up and down pitch that imbues our voices with emotion. That hit me hard. I had been a poetry reader in competitions in high school. I had sung my whole life. I was perhaps a little bit more aware than most non-professional voice users would have been of what an expressive instrument this is. And also I took a certain real pleasure in it. And here he was telling me, you've been limited. And I knew immediately he was right. I've always been a bit of an extrovert. I am pretty verbal and vocal. And what he's telling me is this is in effect changing my personality. I'm becoming slightly more withdrawn.
If, in fact, as Dr. Zeitels said to you, that you are basically projecting a new personality into the world, that must have given you this really deep insight that our voice is fundamental to our identity.
This is precisely what it did do. I think we are not perhaps surprised to hear that everybody's voice is a little different. After all, we tend to know who it is on the other end of a phone. But to have that borne home to you by something as specific as a vocal injury like my own, all of a sudden you're super aware of the truth of that. And I realized that this gravelly voice that I was speaking in was projecting a personality, a lifestyle that I didn't happen to possess. I sounded like a bourbon-drinking guy that smoked two packs of cigarettes a day. it got me really thinking down this path of how our voices are us. They are our identity. So it's not just the matter of timbre, it's also the attack. How hard do you jump at those vowels and consonants? That will suggest temperament. It will suggest someone who's maybe aggressive or someone who's laid back or maybe timid. And what about volume? You know, volume, of course, says a lot about a person's temperament and personality. And then what about things like accent? So in other words, what my voice is carrying is where I came from, how I was educated, possibly what socioeconomic bracket I come from. You know, this voice injury of mine was really achieved through a kind of recklessness, and I had to live it. And then I wrote it in my own book.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. John Colapinto is with us this hour. His book is called This is the Voice. And in it, he explains not just the mechanics of producing these sounds we make, but just how complex it is, how we use pitch and volume to give expression, how we can change our intention or meaning with just the shift of an inflection or a tone, how when our voice changes, like John's did, he changed. But we should probably start with the basics. What is the voice? Is a gasp voice? A laugh? Is that voice? What about a cough? Or really, any of the sounds that aren't words but still express something?
Is it me going, ah, or is it me saying, my name is John? Or is it me singing, my name is John? Or is it coughing? Or is it a laugh? Or is it a whimper? Or is it a tremble? I mean, what is the voice? Aristotle weighed in on the matter. He said it was something that raised an idea in the mind of a listener. So he was really thinking of words, except that science in the 1950s said that coughs and hems and hers and ums and so on are also voice in that they transmit states of mind. And any psychiatrist would know that. They jump on the fact that their patient has suddenly paused or done a, you know, a sort of evasive cough so they don't have to answer the question. I mean, the number of things we're doing with this vocal apparatus that projects us into the world, that communicates our feelings and thoughts is actually beyond vast.
You say that you struck on what you describe as kind of the key to doing this, and that is to think about what makes the human voice different from that of every other creature. So before we get to the distinctions, explain what was that key? What were you thinking about in terms of those differences between humans and how they have voices and the sounds that creatures make?
Well, you can't travel in the landscape of the voice without hearing a lot about non-human animals and their vocalizations, which are amazingly close to our own in that they're produced in exactly the same way through an apparatus in the throat, the vocal cords and larynx, which houses them, that is, you know, indistinguishable virtually from our own. So all the parts look exactly the same. Birds, by the way, vocalize through something that's called the syrinx, which is similar. It's just deeper in the chest. So what ultimately are we doing differently? Well, clearly, we're shaping the vocal sounds into speech, into this sort of game-changing articulation of sequential sounds that are smoothed together into what we call words and sentences that enables us to talk about stuff that's going to happen 3 weeks from now, or evoke things that happened 3 days ago, or talk about an object that doesn't currently exist that we want to make. Maybe it's a tool, maybe it's a weapon. What this did, I realized, by being able to shape our vocal signal into language, it, of course, gave us the ability to elude predators that are much bigger and faster running than us. Where I'm going with this is that this vocal apparatus, and we shouldn't mistake the fact that it's not just language, which is kind of a sequestered abstract thing in our brains that assembles words and thoughts. But in fact, that's no good for anything unless we can get those thoughts out, beamed into the heads of others. The way we did that for hundreds of thousands of years before writing came along, just 5,000 years ago, the way we did that was with our vocal apparatus. So this was the tool, this was the instrument, this was the game changer, and this had not been looked at by science in that context.
We should explain this because I think this is an important element of the book, that there's this distinction to make between language and the voice, because there's this dispute that we have to understand, between Darwin and Chomsky. So scientists usually say the reason humans became such a successful species is because of language. But you make this argument that it's not just that, that it's the voice. Language is only one layer. Take us through this argument that you make in the book, if you would.
All my life, I've actually been reading about how language was our distinguishing feature that brought us to the top of the food chain. I accepted it, as everyone does, because, of course, it's clearly true. I read it in Sapiens just 4 years ago as I was embarking on this book. And if it's in Sapiens, it's got to be true. No, and so all of us glide past that happily until you're writing a book about the voice. And then you start to say, well, how are they defining language? Language tends to be defined by linguists who tend to follow Noam Chomsky, who is the most important and famous and influential linguist that who's ever lived, possibly ever will live, who half a century ago, plus maybe 60 years ago, informed all of us that language is this operation that happens mentally in our heads. We assemble words there. We assemble sentences through grammatical constructions there. And really, the whole question of language is purely concerned with how we do that in our brains. And in fact, Chomsky even believed that language began as thought, not as communication, which would have involved the voice, but instead thought. And then through mechanisms that he doesn't really, he looks at them in that he mentions that they exist, but he doesn't explore. Those thoughts are then gotten out into the world over those hundreds of thousands of years that I mentioned. Well, how were they gotten out? Well, through speech, through talking, through vocalization. So one apostate student of Chomsky's, one of his very first students who took the course in linguistics at MIT right after Chomsky started it was a man named Philip Lieberman. And Lieberman had actually been trained as an engineer. Engineers are interested in how mechanisms work. And he thought, oh, this is so cool what Chomsky is telling us. I mean, it's interesting. I love it. But I mean, isn't there some importance to like the vocal part, the speech part? And he mentioned this to Chomsky, who was not interested. But Lieberman found himself embarking on really a remarkable 60-year journey into looking at this distinction that we can make between language or linguistics and speech, the way that we actually animate all of that stuff that's going up in the cortex to make the air vibrate in ways that lets me project my thoughts into the brains of your audience. And I'm doing it, of course, by making the air really vibrate in these exquisite patterns that communicate ideas. And so Lieberman took that as his bailiwick and wonderfully arrived at the conclusion that this mysterious linguistic capability that Chomsky talked about was not initiated by thought. In fact, Lieberman's breakthrough understanding, to my mind, I call it a breakthrough because it sounds very plausible to me, that in fact, all of those linguistic centers of the brain, so-called linguistic centers, were created by the voice. This was actually an evolution of the vocal tract itself across millions of years, beginning with the lungfish, that gave rise through a feedback loop with the brain to create these articulations of our neuronal connections and circuitry that enabled language, that enabled the first creature to be able to make some noise that indicated a tree or a lion. And that's the quantum leap across animal species. Every non-human animal, from my very intelligent parakeet, who seems to speak English, my little bird is not referring to seeds or anything else that she wants. I mean, she's just singing and imitating my voice. But we are the only one that can link ideas to sounds. And it was Lieberman's feeling, understanding, and incredible research that he did over 60 years to really show that that's very, very likely the case.
I like how you mention Darwin, and you favor this idea of Darwin's, that language capability emerged and evolved out of song.
Yes, I think that's just fascinating. It seems to be right. We of course could never know, but yes, his feeling was, and it was counterintuitive. Everybody that had looked at how language might have evolved before that had looked at words, and it makes sense because, as I just said, that's the thing we do that's unique. We assign a sound, shirt, table, to an object in the world. No other animal can do it. So naturally, you would look at words. But Darwin, because he was Darwin and had seemingly better ideas than anyone's ever had, said, wait, I think it's the music that the words ride on that started it all. And he looked at gibbons, a species of ape that makes the most amazing singing noises that carry, as he put it, triumph, jealousy, anger, territorial. But then we only have to just look at our dogs and cats to realize they do it too. They growl when angry. They mewl and whine when they're, you know, feeling loving or worried. So, I mean, this was also a leap on Darwin's part to understand that animals have emotions. That was critical. So he said that what would have happened is that there would have been an ape who started to introduce into this already highly communicative flow of pitches, rhythms, musical sounds, that little articulation that suggested lion. His feeling was it was probably an imitation, or a sound that lions make, that all of a sudden humans or proto-humans realize, I can do that to say to my friend, there's a lion around the corner, let's be careful. So, and then that began to develop the words that sort of emerged into the flow of prosody.
So I want to key on prosody here. Back to your conversation with the vocal surgeon, Steven Zeitels, because he tells you that with your damaged voice, you were, this is how you put it in the book, you were behaving through a veil of monotone. So you couldn't properly express how you feel. So talk a little bit about how prosody comes into this, because these strategies that you were using, as you say in the book, we're robbing you of this natural variation in pitch and volume and the stuff that people use to, you know, express themselves and give personality to the way they speak. So how does prosody work?
Yeah, prosody, you know, we do it if we're talking about a lion, and then we just want to mention that we also do this with dogs. And then we go back to the lion. You notice I dropped my voice there. So it's one way of guiding you to understanding what on earth I'm talking about. So I let you know with that quick vocal drop that I'm just tucking this idea into a larger idea. So we do that. But we also have an emotional thing. So, you know, I can suddenly sound angry. I mean, there's all these sort of subtle, hidden vocal signals in prosody that convey or can convey hostility and so on. But the thing is that it's sort of like style and writing. You really can't disconnect it from all of the communication we do through speech. And this is what the mistake that people do that take emphasis off the vocal part of our linguistic capability. Because, and this is critical, if I talk like this to you, you will end the podcast. You will say, everyone just tuned out. Because it's excruciating to listen to. It's excruciating to do. It's actually rather difficult to do that. I drained my voice of all prosody. And what happens? You cannot communicate. I mean, literally, the linguistic channel. Because if I had kept that up for a full minute, trust me, you would not be hearing what I'm saying. So, I mean, it is so important. I mean, and this is the way evolution works. It layers useful things on top of previously useful things, so that when your gibbon ape or whatever it was that was making all sorts of highly communicating noises through the melody of its speech, through these operatic songs it sang, those were so useful that we don't get rid of those. We layer new things on top that are still more useful, but we keep the other uses too. So that's a great way to conceptualize how it is that our voices are this amazing lasagna of information and data from the linguistic layer. Let's say that's at the top, because we give primacy, maybe even mistakenly, to the linguistic layer. But, you know, then you've got the musical layer, you've got the accents, you've got the racial voice, you might have sexual orientation encoded in there. I mentioned before that someone can sound educated or not. I mean, the stuff that's coming out through the signal is not just the words. Mm. And that prosody, to my mind, is sort of the second most important, if not the most. I mean, I just can't decide. I go back and forth. But it's certainly underappreciated by linguists, I feel.
Let's talk about how a voice develops in a newborn, before they become born, because and this was fascinating. You mentioned that, of course, that's the first voice a baby hears is in the womb. And in fact, you say the mother's voice is really critical to learning, because the voice is being heard, you say, not only through sound waves, but through, for a baby who's in in the womb through bone conduction. So that voice is being felt.
Yeah.
Talk about that process, how a baby is distinguishing voice and developing voice.
Yeah, it's so fascinating. The baby obviously is floating in amniotic fluid in the mother's belly. And we talk about how babies at 28 weeks gestation, that their auditory system is now complete and they can start hearing and they can hear things from outside the womb. One of the things they hear, of course, is their mother's voice talking, which travels to them through, you know, air vibrations and that penetrate the stomach wall, and the baby hears, literally hears as we do. But the baby is picking up a whole other stimulus of the voice, which is this bone conduction that travels through the mother's body and actually sets the amniotic fluid into vibration. So you got to picture it, kind of enveloping the child's entire body so that voice is felt against the soles of the feet. It's felt against the legs. It's felt against the body and the head and the neck and the face. And so why should that be so important? Well, again, you know, evolution is super smart. It's not intelligent, but it's smart. It's preparing people to live. What have we said is the most important thing to our species at the end of the day? Speech and language. It got us to the top of the food chain. What is the baby first hearing? What is its first, I'm not even hearing, but first perceiving? Well, the mother's voice. What does it hear in the mother's voice? Well, it hears a rumble. It's not very clear. They don't hear vowels and consonants very clearly. What it's really getting is the stress pattern of the mother's native tongue. English tends to emphasize the first syllable of words, baseball, birthday. French is the opposite, garçon. Surprise, not surprise. So actually, and this is true of all languages, they have their own stress patterns. The baby is literally learning language in the womb. And then it's born into a world of voices. So once a baby's born, the learning has to be fast. So the brain is being assembled quick, real quick, so that the baby doesn't die. So one of the things about natural selection, of course, is that it's all very, very dramatic. None of this is sort of a leisurely, the baby kind of learns some language. No, the baby must be inculcated with language as quickly as possible so it doesn't get eaten by a lion.
Well, one of the things that you mentioned about all of this in the book that helped me understand how babies are perceiving voices and learning in this staggering speed is that voiced language is this unbroken ribbon of sounds that are all slurring together, that a baby or any of us, we're not hearing words. We're hearing this, as you say, this ribbon that's unbroken.
Yes, yes. We're really hearing music too.
Yeah.
Because if you think about it, vowels are sung. And you can only sing on a vowel when we actually do sing. But vowels are pitches, and they're distinguished literally by their overtone pitches. The sound signal is very complex. It's like a musical chord. In order to say E or ah, we're sounding different pitches by moving our vocal tract in specific ways. So we're hearing music. And we are hearing, we're hearing percussion. Now, I just separated those out to make those percussive sounds, but we put them into speech. I said, put them into speech. So we are listening to music. And as you mentioned, it's unbroken. We don't know that until we listen to a foreign language and can't tell where the words start and end. And so how does a baby do it?
Yeah.
A baby is running a statistical analysis on every single vocal sound that enters its ears. I mentioned that they're picking up on the stress pattern of their native tongue. They are actually figuring out what letter combinations or sound combinations are legal or illegal in their particular tongue.
Gosh.
So that, yeah, like in Polish, you can say zbigniew. You can put Z and B together, zbigniew. And there's lots of words that have that combination. We don't do it in English. Think of it. There's no zb sound. But when we say leaves blow and glasses break, we realize, oh, wait, no, we do put the Z and B together, but at a word boundary. So that's a clue to a baby where the words can be broken, where the speech chain can actually be separated.
Wow.
What this means is that babies are that unfinished computer of the brain that is born into the world, that is literally being shaped by sensory experience, that is making neural circuitry that is going to be useful to the baby. That baby is wiring the circuits that will permit it to know that zb is not legal in its language. It will actually eliminate, I mean, there are certain sounds in languages, in Japanese, for instance, they don't distinguish between the R and the L sound because they don't hear it as babies, because it's not in their, literally in their language. And so the circuitry for distinguishing those two sounds is pared away to make a brain that is super efficient for hearing its own language. Our brains are sculpted to hear English if we happen to be English.
You also mentioned how the window of language acquisition for a baby is pretty short. And there's this feral child story that you people may be familiar with, this young girl that they know as Jeannie.
Yes.
You want to say something about that? Because I think that's interesting. Like there's this window when you can capture language and then it goes away.
Absolutely. This so-called plasticity of the brain, which we have as babies, it is a limited window because the brain does need to be finished ultimately. And so what happens is after a couple of years, you know, the circuitry is more or less written and set. And we kind of know that because babies that are raised in bilingual environments pick up both languages effortlessly or seemingly effortlessly. But by the time they're 12, when they go and they go into French class, they are cursing because they've got to memorize je suis, tu es, il est. I mean, you know, you can't learn a language in that effortless way anymore because your brain is hardened up and it's now an English brain. So that sort of period, that open period, is also when our ability even to understand language can be inculcated into us. We know that from this terrible story of Jeannie, an abused child who was kept by a crazed father in a back room of the family home, sequestered from all language, tied to a baby seat that had a toilet. I mean, it's just an astounding story of abuse. They wouldn't even speak to, I say they, because he would have the brother bring food into the child and they would growl at it and they would make animal noises at it. When the child eventually was freed, I mean, the mother, the sort of downtrodden mother, eventually took the child out of there and got it to a doctor and a hospital and police and so on and so forth. When linguists then tried to teach this child language at 13 years old, it absolutely would not take. The child could manage a word or two, couldn't string them into sentences. Critically, it's interesting, I read that book many, many years ago and didn't notice until I was doing this voice book that one of the linguists that worked on it actually mentioned her voice and mentioned how underdeveloped it was in terms of its breathing, in terms of its ability to make smooth sounds with the vocal cords. And this goes absolutely to Lieberman's, and I would say Darwin's, idea that really language comes from voice. It comes from practicing voice sounds. It comes from making voice sounds. It comes from imitating mom and dad with our vocal apparatus. And hers duly did not develop.
There's a section in the book about how emotion affects our voices. Talk a little bit about the limbic system, how it plays this role in controlling vocal emotion. And maybe you could get us to the story of the British singer Shirley Collins, because these vocal disorders at, you know, varying levels of severity, you write about it. But the Shirley Collins story I found to be particularly interesting.
Yeah, I mean, one of the ways that our voice evolved was from, it can actually be seen in the layers of the brain that we possess. We have a brain stem, which is responsible for reflexive things like breathing and unconscious things. Or if you hit your finger with a hammer, you'll shout, you'll make a noise. Yeah. That's an unmediated noise. You don't think about it, but it just comes out. It's hardwired. And reptiles have that, lizards and so on. But the next sort of order of animal that evolved were mammals, who actually have a whole other layer of the brain that developed further than we see it in lizards. And that's the limbic system. And what that really is a super efficient and useful way for organisms that are highly social, as mammals are, to tell if someone's friend or foe. And to signal to themselves that they are reacting in a particular way that tells them I'm afraid. And what that really is these, for instance, the amygdala is one of these organs of the limbic system. And when a predator or something fearful is perceived, something unknown, the amygdala literally lets out a chemical that speeds up the heart, speeds up the breathing, prepares the muscles for flight, and then actually is a feedback loop that goes into a higher part of the brain that says, I'm scared. It's critically important that we also be able to signal to others that we are feeling this way. So if we're scared, our limbic responses are to frown, to raise our body higher. But what's the other signaling system? Well, the voice. So dogs will lower their voice to growl. And when they're threatened, they do that really, but a mouse will do it as well. A tiny little mouse. So what are they doing? They're size bluffing. We know that larger bodies create deeper sounds. So animals have learned this over long, long stretches of evolution, and it's become hardwired into our genome, into the animal genome as a whole, scientists have discovered, i.e. every animal signals this way. Every mammal does. High-pitched sounds to sound like a sweet violin, like an unthreatening baby or a lover. Deep sounds for threat. So we have all of that happening in our speech at all times. And again, those are limbic emotional responses. What we've discovered in human beings is that you can create an assault to the limbic system, to the emotion system that's so strong that it affects the vocal apparatus in a way that can shut it down. And one of the most remarkable examples of this, there's a disorder called dysphonia. Mm-hmm. What that is where the vocal cords kind of slam together in a response, probably to make a growl, is my suspicion. Huh. To sort of threaten someone to go away, because that's what we do. We stiffen the vocal cords and press them together so that the air from the lungs flows through less fluidly and smoothly. So the remarkable sort of living example of this was from the 1960s folk singer Shirley Collins, who sang in this sort of delicate, fragile soprano that just broke your heart. She seemed to have, and this is relevant, I think, a direct connection between her limbic centers and what she could do with her voice. There seemed to be this extra sort of salient connection. And she was actually acting in a play which had a lot of singing in it with her husband. She would perform every night wonderfully. And then her husband said, oh, gee, I have fallen in love with one of your cast members that you act with every night on stage. And I'm leaving you. She had two children, small children from an earlier marriage. This was not good. And she had to share a stage nightly with this actress who began wearing a sweater that her husband used to wear, which sort of compounded the injury. She mentioned this. And her voice went into a spasm, a dysphonic spasm, which again, I wonder if it wasn't because she wanted to growl and say, this is my territory, who knows? But the spasmodic dysphonia compressed her vocal cords in a way that rendered her, as she said, almost unable to talk, certainly unable to sing. This lasted for over 20 years. And she was eventually persuaded to make a record just a couple of years ago by some hipster musicians, Lee Rinaldo from Sonic Youth and some other guys. And she made the record, and it's fascinating. I urge people to Google it, because her voice does rasp and it does sound a little constricted, but she is able to get melody into it. It's no longer that fragile, high singing voice. But so the emotion, whatever that disruptive, horrible emotion was, is still somehow lingering. And it's just a remarkable aspect of how our limbic system is heard in all of our voices.
John Colapinto, he's a staff writer for The New Yorker. His book is This Is the Voice. We'll take another break, come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
And the trees in the coombe keep the stars in the sky well hid from the stream. As the stones in its bed wash the water and by, I wonder who'll be in there.
Normally during the Utah legislative session, reporters like me and Emily are on Capitol Hill pretty much every day.
Yeah, well, not this year, Sonia. Because of the pandemic, we've been covering the session from the comfort of our own homes.
So this week on 45 Days, we're going to take you inside a rather empty Capitol and zoom in on the lawmaking process this year.
Check out 45 Days wherever you listen to podcasts or go to 45days.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, John Colapinto, a staff writer at The New Yorker, is with us, talking about his new book, This is the Voice. John damaged his voice years ago. It's one of the things that interested him in the way the voice works and the way it shapes our personality and the way we present ourselves to the world. One of the things you do in the book is you examine how it is the voice works in society. And this gets us to a conversation about accents. Let's start with George Bernard Shaw and his play Pygmalion, or the musical people will be familiar with based on it, sure. Of course, My Fair Lady. You say in the book that Shaw saw his play as this critique of England's class system,
yes.
That people were trapped by their accent, you know, into this social tier.
Absolutely.
Talk a little bit about accents and how this works with voice.
Yeah, you know, my book has an organizing principle around evolution of our species and how we got to the top of the food chain, but evolution also in terms of our societies and our civilization and indeed how we structure them in social stratification, money and wealth, class. George Bernard Shaw was fascinated by this. It was his kind of his leading preoccupation was social reform. He was a strong socialist, but his other fascination was voice. And he correctly understood that one of the most indelible ways that we read class in society is through how people shape the vocal signal, even when they possess a shared language. Which is pretty extraordinary when you think of it, that the mere shaping of your vowels could consign you to the welfare rolls, to unemployment, chronic unemployment, to homelessness. So it's no joke, and he knew it wasn't. But he wrote this light and wonderfully comic, in many ways, play that is so successful that it still rages on in popularity as the movie My Fair Lady, where a speech scientist named Henry Higgins, who was based on one of the most famous vocal scientists of the day, phoneticians of the day, Henry Sweet, takes a Cockney flower girl and makes a bet with a friend and says, you know, I can shape her vocal signal over just a few weeks to the point where she will be mistaken for an aristocrat and it will change her entire life. He proceeds to do so and he succeeds. And really, I mean, it's a much deeper examination of life, society, class, then I think we give it credit for. And, you know, Shaw actually became so fascinated. He really thought that phoneticians of all eccentric things were the most important social reformers. I say that that's eccentric, but maybe it's not.
Is this still present, this idea of an accent sort of trapping you into a place? And England, of course, very class conscious society. Does the role of accent play out differently in the United States in some way? Because you write a bit about this in the book.
We love to think so, and we pride ourselves on it. And we're, of course, wrong. Shaw famously says, an Englishman can't open his mouth without making another Englishman hate him, hate or despise him.
Right.
And I make the point that that's also true of Americans, sadly. And we're particularly acutely aware of it now because of the divisiveness that we've had in our politics and even just in the geography of the country. Now, we have less accents than Britain. It's astounding how many Britain has, given what a small landmass it is. But they've been around for 1,500 years longer with English, so they've had longer. One of the leading linguists in the world, he should be more famous. His name is William LaBeouf, and he is the same age as Chomsky, but he looks at a totally different thing than Chomsky. He looks at actually how languages change, and he looks at accent quite closely. And what he shows is that the difference in the way people shape their vocal sounds, this is actually almost a little bit sad to learn. It has a lot to do with people who disliking each other, people actually making territorial markings against each other. Accents of shared languages are very often people pushing themselves apart. So his first study was a master's thesis on the island of Martha's Vineyard. Tiny little fishing island where the fishing families who had peopled the place since the pilgrims came over, the fishing families were reverting in the 60s to a very ancient accent, which had been captured by linguists generations before, but which had seemingly gone away. And LaBeouf noticed that it was back, why was it back in the 60s? And why was it actually growing stronger in the younger generation? Well, there was a terrible decline in the fishing industry. These people had never been poor. They were the poorest people in the state. And their homes, their ancestral homes on the water, built by the fishing families that are made famous in Moby Dick and that powered the American economy with whale oil and all the rest of it, they were being pushed out into these shacks and the inner part of the island by who? The rich city dwellers of Boston and New York City that were coming to Martha's Vineyard for their summer homes and speaking in accents oh so different. Now, their accents actually used to be somewhat similar. The island accents had started to sort of migrate towards the mainland. But the minute this terrible clash of cultures began, that was based around, of all things, wealth, class, the islanders started to revert to their old accent. It was a way of saying, we own this island. And the voices pushed themselves apart. Lebov, because he's a genius and also ambitious and fearless, thought, well, let's go to the next island, a bigger island. And he went to New York. What an island to then jump to. And for his PhD, he looked at how that way of pronouncing or not pronouncing the R sound in Ka and New York, as Woody Allen or Bernie Sanders would have it, was very, very different from how an aristocratic New Yorker would carve that R quite clearly. Well, that was true of the 60s when Lebov did his amazing study. But earlier, wealthy aristocrats used to drop the R. Witness FDR talking about Fia, yeah. Fia itself. But interestingly, when America became a superpower after winning the Second World War, we suddenly, that dropped R is very British. You think of how they talk about purple and more. You know, they dropped it, and we actually brought that out. They brought that over. But all of a sudden, Americans wanted to sound American. So they were distinguishing themselves against the Brits because we were suddenly a superpower, and they started to carve the R. But then that also comfortably distinguished the aristocrats of Manhattan from the toiling masses like Bernie Sanders and Woody when they were kids, saying, hey, look at that car. Yeah. So, so you've got the accents pushing apart there.
It kind of makes me wonder if the Utah accent is going to get thicker as we try and distinguish ourselves from all of these Californians coming to live here, you know, because it's sort of a thing here. I'm not sure how real it is, but a lot of Californians, a lot of people from other states are coming. And I'm wondering, as a way of distinguishing ourselves, or really in any state, the accent, the particularities of an accent,
yes,
and will thicken. You know what I mean?
Oh, my God, yes. I mean, and Lebov would say for sure. And the vowels will literally begin to distort themselves in your mouths and the mouths of people that come there that are maybe less welcome. I mean, it really does depend to a degree on the amount to which you want these people to assimilate. If there is tension, if there is stress, then you're really going to get the accents pushing themselves apart. Lebov studies how people in the Great Lakes region say, for instead of saying Ann, they say Ian. It almost sounds like the male name Ian. They instead of saying fat, they say fiat. And they were distinguishing themselves in the last two centuries ago from Southerners, from whom they had a very strong clash of ideas and politics. So he talks about how those accents push themselves apart. Wonderfully, he finally did a study of the island of North America. This, talk about an ambitious guy. And his atlas of accents has these isoglosses, which are these lines that he draws to show where there's accent boundaries all through the country. And that looks a little bit like spaghetti thrown onto a map. And I looked at that initially with fascination and then with a sense somewhat of sadness, because those are like the seismographic lines where earthquakes begin, where tensions and stresses are happening. And they're happening because of ideological, sociological, economic differences. And I mean, ordinarily that wouldn't seem troubling, except we've just been through 4 years of a very, very divisive presidency. And where we really saw divisions that are making us feel different from each other. And I guess I feel a little like Shaw. I mean, I've never wanted accents to go away, but I would love society to be less inflamed so that perhaps voices would start to level a little bit. But they're not. And we think they are, but they're not. Lebov does these spectrographic analyses that show that differences are entering vowels.
You mentioned the really fraught territory of an accent, the voice of a particular group of people. And you do get into a discussion about Black English in the book. And I want to read from what you write here. You write, as a Caucasian from Canada, no less, I certainly feel considerable trepidation wading into such troubled waters. But you do take it on anyway, with help from John McWhorter, who a linguist from Columbia, we've had on the program here as well. Yeah. Talk a little bit about Black English, if you will, or as McWhorter describes it as, I think, the Black scent, as he says.
Yes. Yeah. It was something that I knew I had to address because, you know, it would be just sort of an evasion not to because it's something we so clearly do here, as John McWhorter points out. But it's not just McWhorter. You know, it's funny. If we look at the recent if we look at the recent Spike Lee movie, Black Klansman, or Boots Riley's superb movie, whose name is going to now elude me, sadly. Boots Riley's movie about a telemarketer who's Black, who can't make any sales until he learns to do a white sounding voice. I guess what I'm struggling to say, and Richard Pryor, who does a very, very funny or did a very, very funny white voice in his routines. Now, if he's doing a white voice, it must mean that for the main body of his act, he's doing a different voice. And that would be the Black sounding voice. So we get nervous saying that there is such a thing, but comedians and film directors have been happily going there. Now, what is it? And I relied on science and linguists to tell me what it is and where it comes from. And, you know, we know some of the very, very broad things that some African-Americans will say axe instead of ask, and we can hear that, but we also hear it in the shape of vowels and so on. Mm-hmm. So it is extraordinary, the work that was done to look at how this African-American vernacular, as some people call it, really came down from slave populations that were brought here against their will, from different parts of Africa where they did not even have a shared language in many cases. And they were put on plantations to work also alongside, super disenfranchised lower class white people from Britain that were brought over. And so here they all are. They don't speak a common language. And what happens is a pigeon develops where little bits of the language that they can kind of assemble in a generation to sort of get along. They then have children who develop what's called a Creole, which starts to become more like the native tongue of English, but it's got other elements that are mixed in. And then over generations, you do get, people speaking full English, of course, but as I think we talked about earlier, things are inculcated from the womb when you are getting those vibrations, and certain sort of indelible or seemingly indelible little bits and pieces of pronunciation of vowels and shaping of consonants where the tongue exactly hits in the interior of the mouth for a T or a D is slightly different. You get these sort of artifacts of the earlier language, of the earlier speech, I should say, and accent.
So it's cultural. It's not necessarily anatomical.
That's so much what I'm struggling to say here. Yeah. Exactly. It's passed down through what they call mother ease, the way all of our language is. So there's nothing surprising about it. There's nothing shocking. There's nothing rare or unusual. There is absolutely nothing different, as John McWhorter hilariously writes in his book, Talking Back, Talking Black. There's nothing different about the African-American sinuses, as his own mother suggested one time when he was a little boy and said, "Mom, why can I tell that announcer is Black?" So, I mean, why would she know? But no, I mean, there's a difference in the sinuses only in as much as how we shape our tongue and where we place our vellum, our soft palate, will actually have some difference to the way our sinuses resonate the sounds. But no, this is all learned. It's all cultural. It's all wonderful because it's all about the wonderful variety of human behavior and experience. Interestingly, kids, African-Americans that grow up in a neighborhood where that is spoken by their parents, let's say, and by their friends on the street and in school, they will become inculcated with, an adeptness at slipping into that African-American vernacular. But if they happen to go to you know, Princeton or Stanford, as many of them do, and learn, you know, a more professorial form of speech, which they layer over top. When they meet at conferences, I was told by a couple of wonderful Black academics, you know, they told me that they'll sometimes just quickly dip into the old African-American vernacular that they both grew up with in order to do, and I actually use the term verbal fist bump. Mm-hmm. And one of these guys loved that. We're like, yeah, that's exactly right. So, and then they go back perhaps into their standard professorial English.
Don't we all do that when we go back to our hometown?
Correct. It's called code shifting. It's exactly right. Yeah, we just dip in to say, hey, you know, I've been in the States. Maybe I've lost a little bit of my Canadian-ness, but let me give you some oot and a boots to make you realize that, oh, I'm still Johnny. So it's no problem. Of course we do it. We do it to make each other comfortable.
Yeah. Make sense of vocal fry for us, if you will. And I have to say, this is also really fraught because I hear a lot of sexism in this conversation about vocal fry and its connection to young women, for example.
Yes.
How do you talk about this? How do you write about this in the book?
Yeah, vocal fry couldn't be avoided because it is such a remarkable phenomenon, sociological and societal phenomenon right now. Women from about 2010... young women largely, I mean, we hear it in young women's voices. I'll get to males in a sec. But we started to hear that young women were doing something with their voice. They were kind of crackling it. They were sometimes doing it at the end of a sentence or in the middle of a sentence. And then some women started to do it across the full sentence. Mm. And it was so pronounced that linguists started to write about it in linguistic journals. And then it became so pronounced that all of a sudden the nightly news was doing little items on it and saying, what is this? Now, what is it indeed? I did my own little sort of epidemiological look, and I began to think and realize, and I think it's correct, and I did see a scientific paper on it too, that it really begins with Kim Kardashian and the rise of the popularity of her remarkable TV show, which debuted in 2007 but hit peak popularity and ratings in 2010, which is exactly when we saw the vocal fry become epidemic. You know, it's interesting. I had a theory around that revelation as I started writing the book right around the beginning of 2016, I think it was. And that was that the vocal fry, because it puts the voice in a low pitch register that is constant, you literally cannot introduce the prosody of emotion because you're trapped in this one level. What I realized it was doing was draining off emotion. Well, why would you want to do that? If you look at Kim is a pampered Beverly Hills woman who has no troubles in the world, no money troubles, no romantic troubles, because she can just get a new man at the drop of a hat. And it might be Kanye, although I guess there's been some problems since. But anyway, you know, here was a woman who was beyond all cares, and specifically the cares that were attacking a whole generation of young people who were coming of age after a worldwide economic collapse in 2008 that was virtually equal to the Great Depression. So you had young women facing a very uncertain future, romantic, professional, you name it. And lo and behold, they were suddenly speaking in this way that seemed to mirror or echo Kim, who had not a care in the world. You can certainly understand it as kind of a defense mechanism, a way of saying, I'm okay. But my feeling was, as I wrote my way into the book, and as time developed and I watched over those 4 years, the rise of the Me Too movement, the reaction to increased sexism at the top, very top of the U.S. government, I really began to realize, wait a sec. And also the vocal fry wasn't going away. Little, you know, we do have fads in vocal style that, that flare up and then go away. This was not only not going away, it was increasing. And you were seeing it not just in young women, but in older women. You know, you were seeing it in mature women. So what was going on? And this is my own theory, but I think it might be right. I think what women are doing now is reacting to sexism. They are staking their claim now and they're demanding the respect and authority that they've been promised. And why do I say it? Because the vocal fry engages all the exact same set of muscles that are engaged in a growl, in an animal, dog, cat, lion, that goes, rrr. And what it is you stiffen the vocal cords, you press them together so the air comes through in these discrete pops. And You know, I mentioned earlier about how things get sort of hardwired in the animal genome that are emotional in nature. The deep voice being territorial and aggressive, and the high voice being loving and submissive. And this also, I believe, is hardwired. We hear a growl, we know what it's saying. And my feeling is that, you know, the 70s feminism that said, "I am woman, hear me roar," literally, you know, roars are theatrical. They're performative. They're a bit of a bluff, but growls are not. Growls are what dogs descend into right before they attack. So they actually progress from sort of roaring barks of warning to a deep growl, and the next thing is a leap at the throat. I think that women are sending a signal, whether they're conscious of it or not, that they're now ready to actually assume power. They are ready now to stop being sort of welcomed into the boardroom only to have their ideas spoken over or appropriated by men. They're ready to sit on Supreme Court and not be spoken over, as statistics show that they are. They are ready to assume positions of political power like AOC or Elizabeth Warren, and to speak in highly idiosyncratic voices that are not in any way attempting to sound male, as Hillary Clinton was sometimes obliged to do with a kind of unnatural lowering of her pitch, although I think she took way too much heat for her speech. I think she's actually a very good public speaker. But I think that's what we're hearing in the vocal fry.
There's this section in the book where you write about what happens to our voices when we get old. And it made me think of the "All the World's a Stage" speech from Shakespeare's As You Like It, you know, where he talks about the seven ages of man, where in that sixth stage, he describes the aging man's big manly voice, as he describes it, turns again toward childish treble, pipes and whistles in his sound. I was thinking about that when you wrote about how our voices change, what happens to them. What happens when our voices get old? Do they diminish?
Let me first say that I'm very sorry you just said that, because I sought a Shakespearean reference for voice, a salient one for the book, for like 4 years, and never saw that particular one. And it's so perfect. So good. I love it. Yes. You know, our voices are born in a scream. We are born, and the first thing we do, and it's obviously hardwired because we were aquatic before this, but we're born and we know to slam our vocal cords closed at the precise moment that we expel air from the lungs. And we know to shape our mouth and tongue to make that cry really loud. So born in a scream, develops into speech over time through the process that we talked about earlier, and then remains stable. We have a good, strong, clear, communicative voice that aids us in our mating, so we can seduce with it. And in our survival, we can get job interviews through effective sounding, dynamic speech. But then what happens is we age, and all of a sudden the importance of mating falls away because we're too old to do it, or we shouldn't do it because we're so old. Right. And, you know, those differences in male and female voices that are so salient to mating and reproduction go away. Women's voices lower into a more male register. Men's, interestingly, rise into a more female register. We kind of meet in the middle. The power of our voice, our ability to ward off enemies, our ability to win jobs by sounding more dynamic, decreases because the muscular power of our diaphragm starts to weaken and we can't propel the air with the same commanding burst. Our neck gets fatter, and we actually restrict our vocal tract so that it doesn't resonate as well, so we don't sound as boomingly commanding. Our nose falls back in our face and actually makes the chambers smaller as well, and that contributes. We start to bend the spine, and that constricts our lungs so they less effectively push out the air. Our vocal membranes themselves become sort of harder. They don't move with this fluid ripple that is so important to a smooth and beautiful sounding voice, and that starts to get a little crackly and so on. And all of this happens simultaneously with nerve sort of, I won't say damage, but decline, which makes our articulation, which is, it's achieved through these incredible nerve impulses that allow me right now to speak with relative articulateness and clarity, but that starts to go and the vowels blur and the consonants get a little bit fudged up. And I mean, I hate to say it, but our voices really deteriorate in, and they signal to people that we're old and that the next step is death.
You say that in some faith traditions that the human voice is this metaphor for the soul, that it is, you know, evoking this act of giving life. And there's a part of the book where you write about the Gregorian chant and how the chant employs these various vocal strategies, you know, restrained melody, but it also has this really hypnotic effect. So talk a little bit about the chant, if you would, because you describe it as unhooking a chant unhooks us from our internal metronome,
yes,
our pulsing hearts. I was really fascinated in this part.
Yeah, I was fascinated by the Gregorian chant precisely because it is so evocative of religious worship. I'm not religious. I mean, and yet I hear a Gregorian chant and I am transported to some other realm. And I am aware that those voices are somehow evoking something eternal, something non-earthly, something beyond this realm that is measured in the tick-tock of my own pulse that will eventually run down and I will die. And I realized that the singing voices are and the melodies that they sing are all perfectly calibrated to do exactly that, to evoke the eternal. And they do it, and to do it in a way that is ecstatic and yet sober. So the melodies do not go from low to suddenly high in some ecstatic leap. They're not allowed to, because that's not how we ascend to heaven. If we are faithful, we make the graduated steps towards it. And that's what the melodies do. They're allowed to move only one note at a time. So they step upward. Now they're sung in choruses, but those notes all have to be sung in unison. Because if you sing a beautiful Everly's Brother or Beatles-like harmony, it's too beautiful. It's too worldly. It's too sensual and pleasurable. So you ascend all singing together upward towards ecstasy. But you know, you cannot have rhythm. And I think this is probably the most amazing part of it. Those chants, if you listen to them, are unhooked from any beat. So there is no syllable that is stressed harder. There's no syllable that is drawn out longer to make it distinguished from the other syllable. They're sung at the same measured pace. And what that does, as I do put it in the book, is it unhooks it from this metronome that we really do live our lives by our heartbeat. And it has to be that way because, you know, the realm of God and spirituality is unhooked from our temporal sphere. And so the Gregorian chant beautifully evokes that. I mean, it's just an extraordinary, what it really is an extraordinary selling point for the Christian religion. And it was written down. That's really when our musical notation began. And why? So that this way of singing didn't have to be communicated face to face anymore, which is not a good way to make a global religion take over the world. It could now be transported in written form and brought to other countries, other people, other places, other religions in order to co-opt their religion and get them singing these amazing melodies.
You could have had that polyp removed years ago. And for various reasons, as we've talked about, you didn't. Mm-hmm. But it makes me wonder. It doesn't sound like in the book you really feel a sense of regret about that, but it does make me wonder if you think about how your life could have been really different just based on having a different quality of voice. We already talked about how you were creating these strategies to get into different registers and how that really, to me, seems to have transformed your personality in some ways. And just, I'm wondering just over time, how you think your life could have been different if your voice had been different.
Well, it's such a great question. I mean, I interestingly sustained the injury at 40. So I was married already. So I was not using my voice to find a mate. And I'd already had a child. And I was along in my career. I mean, if this had happened when I was 25, a very different life might have unrolled from that. There is no question. And for another reason as well, which was that I wrote songs. I wrote music. I was not unambitious about that. I had some success with playing in an amateur way. I had people say to me, you should pursue that as a career. I would not have been able to do so. I, to be honest, even at 40, I'll be honest, I thought, you know, I should write some songs and get them published. But I realized I wouldn't be able to perform them credibly in a demo. So as a matter of fact, I'm not going to lie. I will say that I did feel some horizon disappear. I will even admit this won't make the podcast, I'm sure, but I interviewed Paul McCartney. We talked about songwriting. He realized I knew what I was talking about. He has a publishing company. He said, send me some songs, John. And I really couldn't do it. I went home and tried to, you know, do some GarageBand demos and never sent them to him. And my songwriter friends say, you're insane. Yeah. But the thing was that, so, I mean, you know, again, it probably won't make the podcast, but I mean, you could argue that, you know, I closed down a potential avenue of income that way, or at least just a continued relationship with Paul, my hero.
Or an adventure, John, an adventure you closed down.
Brilliantly put, an adventure. So, yeah, you know, I mean, I'm not going to lie. It does reverberate through my life. And, you know, I mean, listen, we live in a period of podcasts. I've had people say to me, you should pursue a podcast. You're a pretty fluent speaker. You know, I think, wow, I don't know if my voice could take the vocal load. There are all sorts of ways that I have to think twice because of this voice that I now possess. Why have I left it as it is? And to be honest, it's really because of my commitment to being a writer. The voice that I should be concerned about is the one that I create on the page. And it sounds like a kind of ridiculous purity, but I have throughout my career tried to avoid those things that would lure me away from it too readily, the written word. You know, trying to write good prose is a lifelong pursuit. Trying to communicate the voice I hear in my head onto the page, again, is a lifelong pursuit. I haven't perfected it. And if I've got a compromised, you know, vocal instrument, it's probably all to the good. John Updike said that writers are all too good at talking their books away. I always remembered that. And his inclination was to sequester himself out of Manhattan, to not do too many interviews. He did quite a lot because he was a polite person that wanted to, you know, meet people's expectations. But his warning was, do not talk too much. And boy, he was right, I think.
John Calapinto, thank you very much.
What a great pleasure this was. Thank you so much.
John Calapinto, he's a staff writer for The New Yorker. His new book is This Is the Voice. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. And as always, we'd love to hear from you. We're on Twitter, at Radio West. Our intern is Aaron Camargo, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. Christy Miners is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.